All right, so our next presentation is Adherence to Medication Regimes in Bipolar Disorder, a Subjective Narrative. This presentation is being done by Ruth C. White. She's a PhD, MPH, MSW. Ruth is a clinical associate professor of social work at the University of Southern California. She is the author of Bipolar 101 and the editor of Global Case Studies in Maternal and Child Health. She is presently completing a manuscript on bipolar relapse prevention and proposing a book on policies for the poor. She has worked as a social worker in the UK, Canada, and the USA, and has also worked in Uganda, Belize, and Jamaica.
You're going to have to excuse me because I am blocked up. I've got a cold and I'm barely surviving to make it to today. So I'll get started. Mine has no data. I was very surprised when it got accepted because it is a narrative. It's really about sort of my story and about medications. So medication adherence is really important in most diseases, and in fact, it's a huge issue right now in pharmaceutical companies and with the NIH, because you don't take your medication no matter what is wrong with you. There are all sorts of implications. If you're not taking antibiotics, as we know, we get resistant, and if you don't take your medications for mental health illness, you often have a relapse of symptoms. So I call this system fail, and these are some of the conversation that happens. So usually the doctor says, you know, here are some medications, they'll make you feel better. You're going to have some minor side effects. We hope not too bad. And we're going to work together to make this, well, if you have a really good psychiatrist, they say, we're going to work together and make this have the least negative impact on your body and life. And the response usually for most people is people don't want to be dependent on medication. And it's not just people who have mental illnesses, but people in general don't want to take their cholesterol medication for the rest of their life when they're 40 and they're thinking, I'm going to have to take this for 40 years. Often when people go to get help, they don't feel sick. And because often when you're really, really depressed, you don't go, so you go sort of when you're feeling okay to say, well, I was depressed. And then people feel that they don't want to take the meds once you feel better, even though we psychologically know that taking the meds makes you feel better. Once you feel better, you don't want to take them. And then there is this idea that maybe you're not really ill, it's just people are making me feel that I am ill. And just some data from the CDC around non-adherence, and this is medications in general. So 20-30% of prescriptions are never filled. So talk about adherence, 70% of people are buying the meds. So 20-30% are just off. And then 50% of the people that do get medications, so that's down to about 35%, don't continue as prescribed. And then after the first 6 months, medication adherence drops. So you're getting, you know, less than 25% of people are actually taking their medications as they should be. And this costs between, and that's a wide range, but that's the bottom and top of the scale, between $100 and $289 billion. So my story is that I've been diagnosed with bipolar disorder for over a decade. And I was medication, I was non-adherent at times in my life for various reasons that we're going to talk about. I've been hospitalized and missed work, all that stuff, all the fun that bipolar disorder can be. And I guess what I often say in terms of stigma busting is that I don't look, you know, like the guy with the gun who's shooting people out the window. So for me, people often say, I don't look sick, so, you know, why am I taking all these meds? Are you sure you really need to take all that stuff? And it's a lot of stuff. So I call it pills, pills, pills. There a lot of different kinds of, and these are just a sample of medications that people with bipolar disorder often take. I cannot take antidepressants because they make me manic, which gets me in the hospital. So again, just part of why people don't take certain medications, which means that if I'm depressed, I just kind of have to live with it. Lithium is sort of the gold standard, but is the old standard as well. So there's a lot of new medications that are out there. My doctor always says the newer the medication, the more you are part of the sample, the experimental sample, because often we don't know what's going to happen 20 to 30 years from now. And it's a mood stabilizer. I always say it's natural because it's on the periodic table. Olanzapine is also a mood stabilizer, but comes out of the, what do you call it? I'm sorry, I'm having a blank here. It's more used for schizophrenia, and it comes out of people with epilepsy. So it's an anti-epileptic drug. And it is one of the best sellers for Eli Lilly. It works really well, has really nasty side effects, but it works really well. So you get fat, but you get sane. Ambien and Clonopin are both for sleep. Ambien is famous for its very interesting side effects, people walking in their sleep and driving in their sleep and stuff like that. You know, my doctor, when she gave it to me, she says, please take this while lying down in your bed and lock the door. And you're going, okay, I really want to take that. And Clonopin is a benzodiazepine, also used. It's an anti-anxiety, but also used for sleep. So I just wanted a sample. So people often want to know, does the medication work? And how do you know if it's working? Because bipolar disorder is cyclical. So you're going to feel better sooner or later anyway. So how do you know it's the medication that's making you feel better, or it's not just time? And how do you feel when it's working? Are you feeling less depressed? Are you feeling happy? Are you just blah, which is what a lot of people say they feel like? Is your head foggy? Because olanzapine, for example, can just sort of make your head feel like it's got concrete in it. And would you prefer being ill to being on the medication? And that's often a challenge, more especially with people who are schizophrenic than actually people who are bipolar. One of the challenges of adherence are these three issues: the timing, the dosage, the frequency. When do I have to take it? If you have to take it three times a day, it's kind of easier. You take it at lunch, you take it in the morning, you take it at, if you have to take it four times a day, that's when it gets tricky. And I had to take lithium at one point four times a day, and I couldn't keep track of when I was supposed to take it. And of course, I'm a professor, so you might be teaching when you're supposed to take it. So that the timing was often weird. And with lithium and with a lot of the drugs, they make you sleepy. So I ended up with a bad caffeine addiction, and actually once thought I was manic. And after she asked me about 10 minutes worth of questions, I remember the nurse on call, and I'm calling the emergency, she says, how much coffee have you drank today? And I remember saying, 6 cups. And she said, well, you're overdosed on caffeine. And so that timing issue was really significant, because if I'm teaching, I can't be sleepy. And the dosage, how much you have to take. So a lot of studies around dosage came out of HIV and pill burden, how many pills people had to take and how often. And I always joke now that in HIV you can take one pill a day, and in mental health we don't have that luxury. We don't have combination drugs in the same way that we have in others. And then the frequency, how often. And so if you're thinking about people who are depressed or are manic, and then you have complicated drug regimes, it's likely that they're not going to follow them. Because if you're depressed, you're not motivated, and if you're manic, you don't feel like you should. And as I raised the issue of combination drugs. Side effects in general of most medications are one of the major reasons why people don't take them, whatever the side effects may be. And they range. And in psychotropic medications, and I'm talking anything that's used for mental illness, and I'm just using that broadly. Some of the major ones are things like loss of creativity. People feel they can't write, they can't think, the loss of clarity, loss of function. Drowsiness is huge, which is, I always say to people, that's why when you go into a mental health hospital or a mental health institution, everybody's sitting around calm because they're sleepy. They're just sort of, as I say, over-medicated, but it's not over-medicated, it's just the drugs make you drowsy because they calm you. Tremors are huge. A lot of drugs, when I took lithium in the beginning, I had to use PowerPoint for all my lectures because students thought that I was drunk, because writing on the board was not, my hands would shake like somebody who had Parkinson's. I had to get a stamp for my signature. And what's interesting, I've talked to a lot of other people who've stopped using lithium, and that was one of the reasons. They didn't like the hand shaking. I mean, I couldn't hold a cup of coffee without it spilling. Your motivation to take, I was highly motivated only because I wanted to keep my job. The idea of weight gain is an issue, and for me, that's a huge issue. I don't want to me, the risk of my pancreas, because part of the reason people gain weight is because it affects the pancreas and the functioning of the pancreas. So you're trading your brain for your pancreas. Well, that's the way I see it. It's like, you know, am I going to toss in my kidney so I can get sane? And so a lot of these meds, you have to take blood tests every 3 months to measure kidney and liver function. For me, I blew out my thyroid with lithium, so I had to take thyroid medications. And then about a year ago, I started to have kidney disease related to lithium. And because lithium worked so well for me, I decided I was still going to stay on it but reduce my dose, which makes me then more likely to have symptoms. But I didn't want to start the cycle of a new drug. And my doctor and I said she'd have to go through my records because I've tried so many to figure out which ones are left on the list to try. And so this idea that people should be willing to risk your kidney or risk your liver in order that you're sane for other people is something I just suggest you think about, because when people say people aren't taking their meds, what does that really mean? Because if I get kidney disease, and mine just showed up in just the blood test, it said early renal kidney disease, and it can be reversible if you stop, but that's of course because I go and I take my blood test every 3 months, which I think I'm overdue for. And then the number one reason for most people not adhering to their medications as they should is cost, because we don't live in Canada, we don't live in the UK, we have to pay a lot of money, even with our copay, for medications. So if people don't have money, the first thing that's going to go is their medications. And there are factors that WHO has there's a standard sort of group of factors that play out in non-adherence. And a lot of it has to do with the healthcare system. Did you get good information? Do you have a good relationship with your doctor? Is there cost, if you can't afford it, are there systems in place to allow you? And some drug companies do have scholarships. Patient-related are things like, what is your lifestyle like? Are you staying up at night? Are you you don't like pills? For me, it was really hard to swallow a lot of pills at once for a long time, and I would sort of gag on them. I didn't like the idea of being medication-dependent because I never even had aspirin in my house. I was a person who just didn't take meds. So going from that to taking a combination was a challenge. The therapy issues that I just talked about before, about what it does to your body. The condition, so if you're talking about bipolar disorder, the fact that people are going from manic to depressed means that the way they take their medications are going to vary based on their mood and their feeling about themselves. And then, of course, there's the social stigma of taking medications for mental illness and the economic fallout of not taking it as well as taking it, because you pay to take it so that you can keep your job, but it can also be that you lose your job because you're not taking it. So what can we do to improve adherence? So increasing access. For mental health in the United States, access is it's poor because, and we'll see what happens under the ACA, but in terms of getting access to a psychiatrist, you have to go through a gatekeeper. And actually, once you have a psychiatrist, getting to see the psychiatrist, even if you've been on their client list for a long time and you have a great relationship, it's often slow going. So you have to book weeks in advance to see someone. You can only get reimbursed if you're in crisis, because they have to check that box that says you're actively having symptoms. So if you're not actively having symptoms and you want to do preventive stuff, most insurance companies won't pay for it. Engaging clients so they don't feel like you walk in, there's 15 minutes, here's some drugs, take them. If you take them, you will feel better, see you later, and come back. Of course, again, under the way our health system is, people do only have 15 minutes. And to accommodate the client lifestyle, one of the things my doctor did was after I said, I can't take these drugs during the day and be a professor, like, I can't find words, I'm drowsy. She said, well, you can take them all at night. And I thought, well, I've been taking these things all day for a year and a half. Why didn't you say I could take them all at night? And so taking everything at night was really, I mean, it changed my life. And so understanding what the client's lifestyle, at the same time being a professor, I have certain flexibility. I don't teach in the morning, so if I'm drowsy, it's okay. And then reinforcing the relationship between health and adherence, making people realize and be conscious that when they take it, you do feel better. Explaining the complexity of the drugs. A lot of the drugs, doctors don't know how they work. They work, and nobody understands why. And so you have to inform and educate people. And a lot, I'm online a lot with bipolar support groups, and it's one of the things people just are frustrated with. They like, why am I taking this? I don't understand why it works. All I know is my hands shake, my stomach feels bad, and I have a headache. Simplifying the regimens. With regard to dose, timing, and frequency, it'd be great to get combination drugs. I think there needs to be a professional acknowledgement of the side effects. And I don't think a lot of doctors do that. I was lucky enough to find a doctor eventually that really would understand why I didn't want to take it. And she would empathize with me. And with olanzapine, a lot of people with bipolar disorder take it all the time. I don't. I take it when I'm in crisis. And she knows why, because your weight just sort of, you literally can put on 5 pounds in a week and up to 30 pounds in a month. So 30 pounds in a month is significant, and you don't know how it's going to go, and so you just find yourself getting bigger. And so we would have these conversations. She would say, well, it's time to take the fat drug, I think, you know, and I would say, well, I'm not sure if I want to take it. And she says, well, how are you doing? Let's see how long we can hold out on the fat drug. And we'd call it the fat drug because she knew that that was the one drug that I just did not want to take. We also decided I wasn't going to take antidepressants, and we came to that agreement together because of so many people who have bipolar disorder get manic on antidepressants, and I didn't want to risk it because most people end up in a hospital more likely when you're manic than when you're depressed. And the idea of experimenting with drug holidays, because people tend to do that anyways, they just say, you know what, I don't feel like taking this stuff. I did a couple of those with my doctor's supervision and did it in the summer when I wasn't teaching and I didn't have research, and I just thought, well, if I'm tired, I'll just stay in the bed, and if I'm energetic, I'll just go out. And it didn't have the impact. If I had a 9-to-5 job, taking a drug holiday would be a lot different. So this idea that people sometimes just feel like burdened with these medications and they want to take a drug holiday, and for doctors to be more empathetic to that experience. And then a more holistic conceptualization of disease models. So my next book that I'm writing is looking at things like sleep, your nutrition, your exercise, your social support, that all of these things are really important to mental health. And yet, when you go to get treated, you're thrown drugs and not much else. My doctor often, and she's great, I mean, she used to email me and say things like, the sun's out, because I lived in Seattle for 11 years, so she'd say, the sun's out, get out of the house. And because that was part of her treatment, was like, you need to go out, get fresh air, and get sun, which was not just about medications. She also had a little photocopy of, she used to get everybody recommend light treatment, and she actually had a guy that if you went to him and you had it cheaper online, he'd match that. So she's a very holistic thinker. She gave me omega-3s when omega-3s were still being questioned, and she said to me, look, they're not going to hurt you, but the early data says that it impacts mood. So she literally wrote a prescription and sent me to the pharmacy for omega-3s and in Seattle, vitamin D. So to not just think about adherence around prescription drugs, but that your lifestyle can make a difference. She's also big on getting sleep. As soon as I walk in the door, she'd ask you how you're sleeping. And I remember when I said, I'm down to midnight going to bed. She's like, well, I guess it's better than 3, but 10 would be nice. And the providing support during crisis, because even though that's when you need medications most, that's when you're least likely to take them, because you're just not up to it. Payment assistance programs from drug companies are really important for people who cannot afford, especially a lot of the new drugs are very expensive. Lithium is cheap. That's one of the reasons I like it as well. Peer support, adherence aids, so whether it's logging or people having things on their watches, provide examples of success. When I give talks to social work students, and I start talking and I don't tell them, I don't really give a lot about my background, and then when I say I have bipolar disorder, they look at me going, what? And what's interesting though, I've gotten a lot of letters. I'm gonna meet a guy from Harvard Med School who was out of school for a semester, read my story somewhere else and said he wanted to talk to me. And I get a lot of that from people who are in law school, who are professionals who are trying to decide, can they be professional and have a mental illness? And in Seattle, we started a group called Professional Alliance of Mentally Ill. So people who are professionals who are dealing with some of the challenges, especially do you get promoted if people think you're going to snap? Because that's how people see it. So that's my contact information. On my website, I keep a bipolar blog. And I also have a blog on Psychology Today where I write about current stuff. But the bipolar blog just focuses on current bipolar research. Thank you.